Blog Talk Radio.
Blessed souls, here it comes, the brighter, inner, higher dimension of Isaac Baton's music. Yes, but we're going to turn that down because we got to get on with the show. We're live because we want to stay alive in Torah Chaim, instructions of life, Torah Chesed, instructions of kindness, Torah Rachamim, instructions of mercies. You're now tuned into Soul Class number 415, Secular by Design program, or part 21. We'll be reading from Alan W. Cecil's Secular by Design, a Philosophy of Noahide Laws and Observances, which is accessible to you via the following link, www.amazon.com/secular, and then that horizontal line, I forgot what you call it for the moment, design, horizontal line, philosophy, horizontal Noahide, horizontal observances, /DP/0977-988-538, or you can just type in Alan W. Cecil, C-E-C-I-L, Secular by Design, and you'll find various links how to access this wonderful book. And bless those, before we bring on Alan, who will be co-hosting with us today, I just want to bring something out from the book of Isaiah, Yeshayahu HaNavi, where it's written, "For my thoughts are not like your thoughts," and is written also in the book of Samuel. "He gives thought so that you as exile is not banished forever." And that's from the book of Samuel, chapter 14, verse 14. And who would have thunk, blessed souls, in the 21st century, the century, unfortunately, which is a continuation of the 20th century, we're still dealing with GMOs and is there global warming and global pollution, and there's global warming, and there's unmitigated hatred in the world. Yet amongst all this comes a book, Secular by Design, by Alan W. Cecil, which is like a tekiyat shofar, a blowing of a shofar to say, wait a minute, my fellow human beings, it's time to reconsider. But as we reconsider, let's get to the table of Torah discussion. So let's bring in Alan right now. Alan, who would have thunk that in 2014, you and me, coming from distinctly different backgrounds, would come together to talk about your book? How do you like that one?
Well, I think it's great. I'm glad somebody's talking about it.
Well, if we're talking about it, the angels in heaven are definitely discussing why Don and Alan, Alan and Don, are getting together on this wonderful Tuesday morning here in Kessicon Heights, Brooklyn, New York, live from Turtle Island, a.k.a. the USA, Unifying Souls. Actually, blessed souls, we only have about 25 minutes left, so let's go right into the book, and then, of course, we'll be looking for feedback, embellishments by Alan. So we're turning to page 47, part 1, overview, and Alan began a discussion here. The limitations of the scientific method are explained by Yehuda, or the world we call Judah Levi, or Levi, in the beginning of his book, Torah and Science, and it reads like this, quote, "All concepts of ethics and morality, ideals and desires, law, theology and philosophy, art and beauty, even our personal feelings, love, hate, and fear, are either not quantifiable, or not observable at all." And that's from his book, Levy's Torah and Science, I guess that's chapter 1. And then Alan goes on to ask the following question. What is the quote-unquote reason behind ethics and morality for the intellectual? Well, then he adds a footnote. We find that the serious ethical dilemmas are better handled by Shakespeare and Tolstoy and Schiller and Dostoevsky and George Eliot than the mythical morality tales of the holy books. Hitchens in his book, I'm not going to say the full name because I'm not allowed to say it. Alan, Hitchens asks a question. We should turn to myth instead of historical and not antiquated moral instruction. Why are people looking for myth in the form of Shakespeare or theological or economic or sociological viewpoints of Tolstoy and Schiller instead of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Noah, and Adam, and Methuselah?
Well, so much of our secular society has spent a lot of energy trying to make all that look out as mythological, the Torah. And again, this is what I discussed earlier. The reason they're doing that is they're attacking Christianity. And their attack on Christianity, it's kind of like killing mosquitoes with a cannon. What they're aiming at, they're hitting everything, but it's not the target they're primarily aiming at. What they're attacking is Christian theology, not the Torah. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, mm-hmm. since the Christians took the Tanakh, and they had to glue their own so-called scriptures to it to make them work. The secularists think that, well, that's part of it, and so that's what they're attacking.
So the question is by them, I would say, is they're trying to figure out, do we throw out the baby or the bathwater? I think they're trying to throw out both and trying to figure that people can cleanse themselves without the water of Torah.
They're blowing up the whole bathroom is what they're doing.
Well, you know, I have news for anyone. Whoever's been missing a toilet and had a use mother, you know, go out into the woods. It ain't as pretty as having a toilet. Believe me. With that being said, today's, as we go further into the book, today's intellectual is certainly aware of the need for morality. And there is a footnote here that Alan brings down. Alan, are you outside? Alan?
No, I'm not done. Is there a strange background noise?
Yes, there is. It's kind of like it's either UFOs or crocodiles from your Floridian home trying to get into your house.
Yeah, okay. I shoot them away.
Okay, very good. Did you use a cannonball?
I did.
Okay, so Alan quotes here Harris, who I guess is another atheist, where Harris even admits in his book The End of Faith, which maybe he's ended his faith. I want to continue with mine. It is the time for us to admit that not all cultures are at the same stage of moral development. Now, that's an interesting point of view because I would think, Alan, that for Harris to make that assertion, he might himself start to become a little bit ethnocentric based on his own values of what are the values that all cultures should adhere to. And we say that's impossible. What's that?
You think?
You know, there are universal cultural values which precede all human culture in terms of how human culture eventually developed after the flood, and those are the 7 Noahide commandments, which should be the cultural norms for any society and puts all societies at the same, should we say, they're all at the starting line in terms of actualizing their potential. But Harris comes along and says, well, I'll just say that not all cultures are the same stage of moral development. Well, who's more morally developed? The developed world, which is destroying the world, or the undeveloped world, who are not destroying the world, but perhaps not going further in certain levels of their development? I'm not going to judge. I'm, you know, the being that I'm living in so-called the Western world, there's a give and take of what's good and what's evil. There's nothing really defined because people are afraid to stamp the universal 7 Noahide commandments, whether in a theological sense or a secular sense, into implementation. I can only say that I don't see how a person can come to measure how we all get the human family experience at the same stage of moral development without the seven Noahic commandments. Your take on that, Alan?
Well, that is a problem, and people like Harris, I don't know, for him to sit there and think, well, what he's implying, of course, is, yes, you know, the Western civilization, particularly the secular humanists, are the most advanced. That is kind of what he's implying. And it's just really, I don't know, what they're comparing it to. I mean, what do you compare it to? The Aborigines, the tribes in the Amazon rainforest? I don't know. It's just really kind of odd of what they're talking about. But you know what? In the book, I go on just after this. I talk about what happened to the most advanced Western civilization in the early mid 20th century.
Well, I don't know if we'll get to that today, Alan, but hopefully in the next show or in two shows with Hashem's blessing, we'll get to that. And hint, hint, blessed souls, he's talking about the civilization of the Nazis, the self-promoting thousand-year reign of that demonic culture, which only lasted about 12 years. With that being said, I mean, I guess in terms of cultural promotion, if a culture can achieve, let's see, 1/80th of its societal view, I guess it's a failing culture, and probably they didn't have any development. Going further into Alan's book, he then goes on to quote the question put to us by Richard Dawkins, another delusionary human being who quotes his delusions as scientific fact. Quote unquote, if we reject, this is Alan quoting Hawkins, if we reject Deuteronomy and Leviticus, as all enlightened moderns do, as Alan put in italics, in parentheses, I guess that's quoting right from Dawkins, by what criteria do we then decide which of religion's moral values to accept? And that's quoting from page 81 of The Delusionary One by Dawkins. I'm not even going to say the name of his book. So, Alan, how is society going to come to some sort of sense of criteria if they don't believe in any criteria from previous generations? Are they so enlightened in their existentialism that they feel the modern generation can solve all the problems? Do people like Dawkins really believe that?
I'm afraid so. But you know, the funny thing is, you would think that if you were going to judge between two sets of values, you would study them side by side and determine which one would be the logical choice. They don't do that with the Torah. They do not even look at it. They don't read it. They don't study it. Again, what they are attacking, what are they're comparing it to, is the Christian theological interpretations. And it's just, I don't know, it's like judging a culture's artwork by that culture's kindergartners.
Mm-hmm. I hear you saying,
I don't know. It's a very troubling issue, but you know that's the problem that we have in our society. There has been a systematic push to keep the Torah out of academic discussion.
True. And when we talk about people looking at other cultures and looking at merely like the kindergarten level, we have to remember in certain cultures, there is a outlook on life that one doesn't develop in terms of, one is not forced to, say, by 18 finish school, 22 get the college degree, or 24, 25 get the master's degree. Other cultures in this world promote the idea that a person will advance at their own rate, and those people maybe were behind, so to speak, culturally or in relation to other cultures at the cultural age of 5, by the age of 55, they're way beyond the cultural norms of civilizations which have been going on for thousands of years, or at least thousands of years. Let's say like the Western Greek Roman civilization outlook, which is quite, I might say, very, I would say, and they like to extract out, Alan, from my perception, from their antiquity, some good things, but all the evil and all the suppression of knowledge of other viewpoints, they either like to say, well, it came from us, or it's no longer needed. And that type of intellectual dishonesty, from a Torah perspective, I find very, very distasteful. Any take on that?
It is distasteful, and it should trouble people. Side note, a while back I watched a show, a little documentary about the Tower of London in England. You know, and they talk about this tower is like 1,000 years old, and they have all these ancient, you know, centuries-old ceremonies. I mean, you know, the outfits they wear, they have to march around a certain way, give these certain little passwords. There's this whole, all these traditions and things that they do, and they're all proud of it. But the thing is, yeah, these things, I mean, what do they mean? Where do they come from? I don't recall any of that being in the Tanakh. They're supposed to do that.
Right.
And yet these same people, the same culture, consistently, this is the culture of Dawkins and Hitchens, by the way, they consistently belittle the Torah, the Jews. Oh, look at those silly things that they do. But the thing is, they do things that are even much sillier. You know, look at you know, like the beef eaters, those huge bearskin hats they wear, you know, the way they march. I mean, what on earth are they doing? Where do these,
right.
What is so important about those traditions?
Right.
I don't know. You know, you get, you know, and they talk about, oh, our traditions are so old. They go back almost 1,000 years. How old do the traditions of the Torah go back, for crying out loud?
Well, we would say they go back all the way back to creation with Adam and Eve.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, just talking about things like palace and mezuzahs. You know,
oh, those things. Okay,
that
that's thousands
of years. You know,
that's 3,000 officially in the Judaic sense, Mosaic Judaic sense. We're talking 3,326 and a half years.
And 13 days. It's just really absurd to me that they have that kind of attitude. You know, they don't think about, you know, the traditions of the Torah are, you know, you call them traditions, I mean, they're commandments. You know, they belittle that, and yet they spend their time doing all these ridiculous, silly things.
Right. You know, Ellen, my mind is reminding me, in My Fair Lady, Professor Higgins is talking about why can't the English speak like me, and he makes a pithy little remark about how the Hebrews read from right to left and how that's extremely frightening to him. Now, I don't know what's frightening about reading from right to left, and I don't see what's so enlightening about reading from left to right. I mean, if we write from right to left, it's not a contradiction to reading left to right. I mean, that's the way we read. And our books go in the opposite direction, say, like English Western books. But I enjoy reading English Western books from left to right, and there's a purpose in it. Why is it like that? I haven't really learned the reason. But that type of pithy remark just kind of, you know, it's more than just Dawkins and Hitchens, Alan. It comes down to like the layman is subliminally brainwashed, you know, paradoxically in an overt way that it's quite frightening, that old Hebrew approach. You know.
Ow. I ask you, what sort of sound is that? That was a great scene there. I don't know. It has to do with like what you discussed earlier about the cultural ethnocentric views that we have. Our culture's the best. We're number one. I don't know. I don't have an answer why people are like that. Even like Sam Harris, who talks about, you know, the open-minded person must be open to new facts. Well, they
right.
don't look at the facts, do they?
True. With that being said, what's going on in Ellen's book, that Dawkins promotes that the only way to develop a criteria for what are the religion's moral values, the only criteria by which we can decide by which of religion's moral values are acceptable, according to the Dawkins viewpoint, would be by studying the morality and protocols of, quote-unquote, the enlightened moderns, which brings us to footnote 37, where we'll be turning now to Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, with the following I want to share with the blessed souls from his collective writings, Volume 1, page 356. Trying to get into the idea, Rav Hirsch is, so to speak, enclosing himself into the idea of the secular-minded person who would try to break away from the umbrella, universal umbrella outlook of Torah. And it reads as follows. The intellectual, therefore, must try to scorn Torah in order to justify himself in his own eyes. For he must seek a position by virtue of which, as he imagines, he will be above these Torah-loyal people, a position which enables him to look down on them with scorn and contempt because they still confine themselves within the boundaries of the divine law. He must persuade himself that his sophisms, his brand of wisdom, and his apostasy constitute progress, that his dissoluteness constitutes freedom. He must convince himself that the law was clearly not given to him, that it was not given to a man of breeding and discernment such as he, nor to men of his social rank, nor to men who possess whatever other qualities he ascribes to himself. He must convince himself, and I can only I can hear like the Olympian sounding song, music of the introduction to like the movie Hercules. He must convince himself, and listen, imagine if you're listening to the opening scene to Hercules, the music. He must convince himself that the divine law would have no significance or value in the Olympian realms where his intellect dwells. There he removes all, quote-unquote, drivel from the divine law until it can be easily perceived that much of the law is anachronistic, until it is obvious that this, quote-unquote, irrelevant material is valuable only for those who have not yet mentally escaped from under the Egyptian burden of bricks, or for those who still breathe the oppressive air of exile and medieval darkness. He declares that this irrelevant material must have been beneficial and necessary in former times, but certainly cannot be of any use to free men. They're on the sublime heights. The intellectual rabbis are separated from the intellectual patricians, and the law which was dictated by God is left to the intellectually impoverished, the uneducated, and the ignorant. And there the superior man, sounds a little Nietzsche to me, confers upon himself the diploma of rationalism, enlightenment, or whatever beautiful terms they use to describe it. He stigmatizes those who are loyal to the law, describing them disparagingly as living in darkness and superstition, as is irrationally clinging to quote-unquote rigid religious formalism, end of quote. But, you know, Rav Hirsch is addressing that mentality. But I want to remind everyone, in the five books of Moses, there is no word which depicts Torah as a religion. Hint, hint, a Torah lifestyle is not a religion. And hint, 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 the Seven Noahide Commandments is not a religion either. Any comments on that, Alan?
Well, I
yes.
Tell you what, nobody hits the nail on the head like Rav Hirsch. That is exactly what the problem has been. These people think they're superior. You know, they do everything they can to disparage the Torah and Torah true Jews and Noahides, but you know, the funny thing is they don't know anything about it. And again, they're what they're attacking is not Torah at all. So I don't know. Talk about people being deluded.
True. And you know, since that no one has come forth with those solutions yet on how to improve the human family condition on a global scale, aside from those who are saying there's a conspiracy theory, there's this family or that family, the Illuminati, okay, whoever they may be, we know from the Jewish nation there's always been people who like to play games with other people. I'm being politically correct, or you know, if I want to get more fire and brimstone, there's always been some pretty evil dudes hanging out in the corner of every civilization who seem to want to build up the civilization based on their, so to speak, dysfunctional thinking, which is accepted as national or cultural norms. We know that. Just ask, you know, the people who've gone through communist Russia, people who lived under Mao Zedong with that little red book, you know, or what else? Nazi Germany, you know, these a few dysfunctionally human beings in terms of understanding the purpose of humanity have taken their dreams and turned and enforced their dreams to the point where we have to believe their dreams, which are really our nightmares, become our realities until we can extricate ourselves up by just, you know, getting to a higher level of consciousness, which the Seven Noahide Commandments afford any human being of waking up, and for a Jew, it's the 613 commandments. So, Alan, at this point, we're going to actually conclude the show. I think it's been a very potent presentation here. I want to thank you very much for your time. For this week's program, can you think of something in a practical, down-to-earth way that anyone listening to the program, who is of the Gentile nations, anyone of the blessed nations of the earth, what they can do today to get a little bit more in touch with their responsibilities as, from their genealogy? Not that we're making religion. If you keep the seven mitzvahs, you become a Noahide. You are a Noahide from the perspective of genealogy. That's how I look at it. What advice can you give to anyone out there, what they can do today to come a little bit closer to making a better world through the 700 commandments?
Well, I would suggest to anyone to Google the dark side of Greek and Roman civilization and culture. A point you brought up earlier, I mean, it emulates in our Western culture is based on Greek and Roman culture. Look at some of the things that they did that, like you said, we pick out the good things, kind of whitewash the bad things. But there was a lot of things, I mean, you know, their love of war, of fighting, infanticide, oppressing the poor. There's a lot of things that they did that were, as you said, evil. And these are the cultures that the Dawkinses and the Hitchens want us to turn to for the answers. So I think people out there should study more about where our culture really came from, the good and the bad.
True. And Ellen, I look at it this way. It's not like we're not, I'm going to say it publicly, we're not out to destroy the systems we live in. We're here to elevate them and rectify them. You know, we're not in a situation where someone's going to come up to Paro, the modern-day Pharaoh, and say, let my people go. No, we don't expect it that way. In fact, the Lubavitch Rebbe spoke about over 23 years ago, that it will not be a surprise to us when the universal redemption kicks in, because it's going to happen in a natural fashion, meaning human consciousness will be elevated. So just as, you know, there have been efforts, an expression of that elevation of consciousness was, say, for instance, the ending of slavery. But it didn't end there, because then, you know, the forerunners of the NRA came up, and the KKK came up, and the lack of education, economic opportunity transpired for the African-American peoples over here that in their diaspora experience over here. So there was something good that happened in America, but still, to me, it's very sickening to see this repetition of black and white clashing. These are things that should have been rectified 50, 60 years ago in times of Dr. Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. And because of the lack of presentation of Torah teachings, because when we come to realize, blessed souls, that everyone is made, when everyone realizes everyone else has a divine image, we stop looking at the color of our skin, we start looking at the color of the eyes, and we start to look at the context of character, and how can we improve one and the other's character by clinging on to universal values, whether we want to make it in a theological sense, but not making a new religion, but in a practical sense in terms of improving society. So I'd like to thank you, Alan. And
thank you, Bob.
With that being said, we're gonna end up with our song-ending music of David Domes. It's Nice to Know, because I think discussions like this, I think more and more people will be saying, it's nice to know. And with David Dome, you can be guaranteed blessings on souls. He'll help you get back home to understand your divine image. We'll help you get from scrimmage. Your tzelem elokim is no dream. And remember, tevet tov lehetiv, it's the nature of the good to good. Do good, and you can do good because it's embedded in your DNA. Embedded in your DNA is not racism or jealousy or hatred. Embedded in your DNA, connected to your divine image, is to do the Creator's will, as you understand it, and as you learn more about the seven Noahic commandments or the 613 commandments, you'll be able to say and share it with another neighbor, it's nice to know. Here's David Domes. It's nice to know. Take care, everyone.
Lack. It's that monkey on my back.